If you call me to love, I won't back down, even if they say it's crazy. At the front of the line, at the end of my time, as you call, I'll be there praying.
Come on, Talizoba, Talizoba. For the past 2 years, Myanmar has recorded the most deaths and injuries from landmines and explosive remnants of war of any country in the world. In 2024, reported casualties more than doubled from the previous year, in statistics that assuredly undercount the devastation caused by these terrible weapons. Although Myanmar had already seen decades of landmine contamination, since the 2021 coup and subsequent conflict, there's been a sharp increase in the deadly and indiscriminate use of anti-personnel mines, with children and other civilians suffering the consequences. People are being maimed and killed in the course of their daily lives, shattering families and disrupting livelihoods, with a persistent threat that could last generations. Insight Myanmar's in-depth series titled Navigating a Minefield explores the situation on the ground, impacts on survivors and communities, and humanitarian mine action making a difference at the local, national, and international levels. We are joining a network of independent news media publishing in Burmese, ethnic language, and English, both in Myanmar and in the diaspora, to raise awareness about the dangers of landmines and explosive remnants of war, as well as action that can save lives and support community leadership. More information about the series is available on the Insight Myanmar website under the Mine Action section.
Back. My guest today is Jonathan Moss, and he has been working with the Free Burma Rangers on community-driven demining projects in Myanmar, that is the systematic removal of landmines. And it's very important work, and it's a very fascinating topic. This is a re-record of an interview we've previously done, with the intention of going even more into depth and discussing even more details of the work that John and the Free Burma Rangers have been doing on this. So if there is some context that appears to be missing to the audience, I apologize in advance for that. John, before we jump into this topic, I just want to give you the floor to open up about yourself, your background, your experiences, and anything you think the audience should know going in.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on the show and just for caring about Burma and the people that are living there with the daily reality of landmines. This work, it means a lot to me. It's close to my heart. And I'm just super grateful that you're using your platform to help tell the story of these people here. So I wanted to start with just a little background on myself. My name is Jonathan Moss, and I was born and raised in Pasadena, California. And it was shortly after 9/11 happened that I felt compelled to go into public service. So graduated from USC, and I joined Teach for America in 2008. And I taught elementary school in Compton for 5 years. I earned a master's degree in education at UCLA while I was teaching. And then in 2014, after seeing images of some Syrian children that were killed by chemical attacks, I decided to join the military. So I joined the Navy and became an explosive ordnance disposal officer, serving for 8 years. And I was trained to identify, render safe, all types of explosive threats on land, in the air, and underwater. A lot of the training I had included diving, airborne operations, demolitions, IEDs, and chemical and radiological hazards. And it was on one deployment that I had that I learned about Burma's long civil war and all the landmine contamination over there. And so I got connected with the Free Burma Rangers, and I felt like I wanted to do something to help. So it was in 2022 that I got out of the Navy, and then I went over to Burma. The first time I went over there, I helped with a lot of frontline medical support, helping bringing aid to a lot of the IDP camps, and then helping to work on mine clearance and explosive hazard reduction stuff. And then in 2023, I went back to the U.S. I studied human rights and leadership at Harvard. And then in March of 2025, moved back to Thailand with my wife, Rachel, and our son. And my wife, Rachel, she's a licensed mental health therapist, and she used to work for Wounded Warrior Project as an adventure therapist. So she's used to working with soldiers that have all sorts of injuries, and she now supports landmine survivors through trauma care. So we're working to together build a local-led demining effort in Burma, and we're focusing on training and equipping ethnic teams and trying to figure out how we can help them clear mines and then also support survivors locally.
I mean, that's like, it's an incredible story, like the personal sort of development and dedication, but it's also, I mean, just the very concept here of community-led demining projects. I mean, that obviously we're going to go way into depth on that down the line here, but it's just such an incredible idea. And I think it's such a vital, I don't want to minimize the work that you're doing by calling it an experiment, but the results of the work that you're doing, if this succeeds in the way that you're hoping and that we're all hoping, I think could really lay the groundwork for something incredible worldwide. So definitely looking forward to seeing how this progresses. But before we get ahead of ourselves, because I know there's a lot for us to jump into here, I just want to make sure that we've got the groundwork laid here. So with regards to landmines in Burma, obviously there are a lot of landmines. The military have been using them. To the best of my knowledge, they are not signatories to any international conventions on the use of landmines or the minimization of landmines or commitment to cleaning up landmines and so on. So they seem to be very widely deployed. Can you put it in scope for us? How widespread is this problem? What percentage of the population is living near landmines, in fear of landmines? Is there a number we can put on the number of landmines around the country? And can we compare this to other countries?
Yeah. So I'll give an overview just of landmines in Burma and Free Burma Rangers involvement. So FBR has been involved in Burma for about 32 years. Landmines, they've been in heavy use the entire time, and they still are today. Every Burma Army camp is surrounded by landmines. That hasn't changed the entire time. And very early on, it was mostly MM1s and MM2s and some Chinese bouncing mines. And the M14 showed up a lot later. Dave Eubank has said that was probably within the last 20 years. I did not see, or he did not see them in the field before that. But now the M14 is very common. And the pattern in which they're laid has stayed the same, according to Dave. Concentric rings of landmines around camps and mines along roads, trails, and crossings. Villages are attacked, people are chased out, and then homes are looted and burned. And then the villages are mined. And that's been consistent from the beginning, from when FBR began until now. And then even recently in Kearney State, there were landmines placed right at the front doors of homes and that had already been destroyed by the Burma Army. And then people came back to look for their belongings, and then they stepped on mines. So this has been happening for the entire war. And then as far as like the scale and the supply of landmines, the Burma Army is escalating all their offensives, especially ahead of a lot of these planned elections. And the attacks are pushing civilians into new displacement. Mines are being laid not only for defense, but to target civilians. IDP routes that IDPs would travel on, food paths, water access points, we're increasingly seeing them contaminated with landmines. And then the conflict lines that we're seeing are shifting very fast, so making any attempt that they might have to map and clearance operations even more complex. And it's not localized, and it's not fading either. It's expanding very fast. Right now, it's over 60% of Burma is contaminated with landmines. So So that's over 200 townships across the country. And the numbers keep rising. So some of the numbers that I have, it's in 2023, the recorders had tracked over 1,000 civilian casualties in Burma. That was the highest civilian total in the world. And then in 2024, they recorded, it was just over 1,600 civilian casualties. So that's, to put it in perspective, that's nearly 5 casualties per day. And these are also just major undercounts. Many of the incidents go unreported and tracking is very limited in a lot of these active conflict areas. So it's also important to note that these totals only include civilians. They don't include Burma Army or resistance fighters. And then the majority of victims, to classify them, they are adult men, and they're often the main income earners for their families. But children and women are increasingly being affected. And children are now making up a growing share of the casualties, especially from UXO that they find and then they pick up. Since the coup, contamination has expanded very rapidly. And by 2025, contamination has spread now to nearly every state and region in Burma. So it's not historical contamination that's resurfacing. It's active and it's ongoing deployment of these explosives from the Burma Army across civilian landscapes. And the use of landmines, like I said, it continues to increase. So like a typical resupply drop to a Burma Army camp, that includes between 200 and 500 M14 landmines. So that happens roughly every 3 months, according to data that we have at Free Burma Rangers. And then there are people on the ground that are seeing bags holding over 300 mines at one time that are being resupplied to these camps. And then in Papun, one outer position alone had about 30 M14s waiting to be laid. And some camps like Pazong, they had over 5,000 M14s around them. So they're placed around camps, along approaches, on trails, and around villages that have been attacked.
So I want to dive into this a little bit. And obviously, you've given quite a lot of context and information here. And I know this is something that we went into quite a bit in our first attempt at recording. The use of the landmines is something that I think we have to discuss and we have to bring up, because in conventional warfare, even though landmines are very heavily regulated, are very, very discouraged, conventionally you would lay landmines purely as an area denial tactic. You are supposed to, even in times of war, demarcate where those landmines are. You are supposed to track or keep records of where you've placed them so that you can demine later. And the idea is that they are supposed to stop advancing military operations. We could look at the North Korea, South Korea demilitarized zone as a good example of just a area denial deterrent. But what you were saying comports with what we heard from reporters who have gone into Karen and Kareni state, namely that people who return to their villages and their homes are finding landmines in their houses, in their doorways, in fields where they used to, grow vegetables or herbs or what have you. And that the landmines are being used not so much to deny areas to military operations, but are being used specifically to target civilians. I believe you mentioned also laying the mines along IDP / refugee routes of transit. So I just want to linger on this point a little bit, because I think it is essential that we bring this into the open and we make it clear to people that these landmines are not a sort of unfortunate relic of fundamentally strategically and tactically sound military action. And I want to confirm that this is in fact what you're saying, is that these landmines are being deliberately and intentionally used from the get-go as booby traps to take out civilians who have no relationship whatsoever to armed conflict.
Yeah, that's correct. It's absolutely the case. These mines are being laid in areas where civilians are going to go back to. One of the areas that we went to on our last mission in Kareni State, we were helping to clear a church ground. And in the process of that clearance, we got to also see other parts of this village. And one of the main concerns was, what do these local people do with homes that are booby trapped? So after the villages are burned and looted and the Burma army leaves, they will actually booby trap the front doors to the homes. And they are specifically targeting anyone that would try to return. And so most of the time, what they'll do is they will either just blow the whole house up and trip the booby trap. And it really is just so dangerous and so risky for them to try to disarm it. But sometimes they will also attempt to disarm it just using the rudimentary tools that they have. That's one example where civilians are targeted in their homes. But there's also, we've also been in churches where they left landmines right at the entrance to where you would proceed into the church, where the walkways are, where the front door is, right in front where any civilian would go and try and worship. Landmines have been placed there, and people have stepped on those mines trying to go back to their churches. We have lots of stories of farmers as well going back to their fields, just trying to work on their land and till their soil, plant rice, stepping on mines. So the reality is that of what we're seeing on the ground is civilians are being targeted in lots of different areas.
I mean, this is absolutely horrific stuff. And adding to that, you made mention multiple times as you were talking, specifically of the M14. Presuming that the majority of the people in our audience are not up on their mine designations, can you lay out for us exactly what an M14 mine is and why it's so significantly different than the conventional sort of World War II through to Vietnam era conceptualization that most people have of landmines?
Sure. Yeah. So just first off, landmines, they cause far more injuries than UXO. So UXO is unexploded ordnance. So they're far more dangerous right now in Burma than landmines are far more dangerous than any unexploded ordnance. People often know how to avoid or deal with UXO, but mines are hidden. They're a lot different. Specifically the M14, it's low metal, made almost entirely out of plastic and extremely difficult to detect. There's just a small metal pin inside of it that needs to be detected if you have a detector. And that sometimes never shows up. For example, on this last Kearney mission, we brought a detector with us. We brought our detector into a mined area and we had done a test sweep. And when we conducted our test sweep, our detector could not detect this M14 mine. That's a major problem because that's the one that we see everywhere. That's the largest problem. That's the one that is injuring and killing and maiming people the most. So it's a very small mine, anti-personnel mine, smaller than the center of the palm of my hand. And it's just enough explosive to blow the front of your foot off, maybe your toes. And, it could also blow part of your leg off as well. And they're very easy to put into the ground with just a very thin layer of soil on the top. So they're everywhere.
They're genuinely horrific. And some of the audience may have heard this already. Not long ago, a friend of the channel, Colin Mayfield, is an investigative journalist who was embedded in Chin State, did in fact step on an M14. Landmine. He suffered non-life-threatening but still quite serious injuries, and has been extracted and is in quite a lot of pain. And he is very keen to share his experiences, and he's already uploaded a number of videos about his experience. They are quite gruesome, but if anybody wants to understand just how despicable and destructive these devices are, there is plenty of evidence around. There's plenty of documentation around that that shows just how horrific these little explosives can be. And I just want to get a concept of how you would approach it, because since our last discussion, I've been thinking about landmines, and I'm just wondering what sort of options you have. You say your detector doesn't pick it up, and that's obviously the purpose of a minimal metal mine. Are there solutions that make sense? I mean, for example, how much weight or impact do you need to trigger it? Could you, for example, get a remote controlled toy car and weight it down with something and just drive it around a property in the hopes of exploding a mine, or is it significantly more difficult to get just the right amount of pressure to try to trick these mines into going off?
Yeah, so the M14 mine, it requires a low amount of pressure for it to actually trigger itself. So it's made for somebody on foot just to step on it. And if you want to disarm it, sometimes people, they can shoot at it. They can also drop weight on it to have it go off. If you try to drive like a car, or if you try to just roll something over the top of it, it's not really made to function that way. It requires like direct pressure right on top of the very small pressure plate right on the surface of it. So the M14 is designed for a person to step on it, usually with their toe or their heel. It's called a toe popper, actually, because it takes your toe just to put just enough pressure on the top of it for it to go off.
Okay, interesting. So that presents quite a bit of difficulty for you. And before we get more into like the tactics that you would use to defuse them, I want to understand a little bit more about the effect that this has on the community, because as you said, civilians are specifically being targeted, and you've so far mentioned in particular homes are being booby trapped, places of worship are being booby trapped, places of agriculture are being booby trapped, and commonly used pathways, means of transit are being booby trapped. So these are quite essential and critical to life in a village. If you want to grow food, if you want to gather for prayers, which, you know, obviously in a lot of villages is incredibly important, centralizing part of community life. If you want to go into the woods to gather, you know, food, vegetables, firewood, hunt, whatever the case may be, every aspect of your life, you are running the risk of stepping on a landmine and possibly dying or becoming, you know, permanently maimed. So how does this impact the village? How does this impact life? How do people respond to that? Do they just roll the dice because you have to do what you have to do, and you have to take that risk because you don't have an alternative? Or does it cause people to stay a little bit more sedentary, a little bit more isolated, more hesitant to get outside and farm or hunt or gather or you know, even visit from one house to another house? What is the impact of this whole strategy by the military on the impacted communities?
Yeah, so it's the longest running civil war in the world, and it's now over 75 years, and more than 30 million people have been displaced over time, and that's out of a population of around 60 million. And in just the last 4 years, that's about 4.5 million people being displaced again, and thousands of those people have stepped on these landmines, and it's a war between people who want freedom and a military dictatorship that's backed by Russia and China. And the landmines that are being laid, they're doing a lot more than just injuring or killing. They're preventing people from returning home. And even if the military leaves, people, they're afraid to return to their land to retrieve their belongings or to care for their livestock. In one small village near Damoso, over 100 landmines were found in a single month after the Burma army passed through. In another village, 8 mines placed around a church that had already been burned. And then in some other areas, over 100 mines were found in and around another village. So mines are placed in rice fields, on paths through the jungle, areas where people rely on for food. And it's creating a long-term hunger and displacement issue. And like I said, everyone's impacted by it. In 2022 alone, there were over 36 civilian landmine victims in one area of Karini. And that doesn't, like I've already said, doesn't include military casualties. Children, adults, old people are all affected, and so are the animals. So FBR has treated cows. They've treated water buffalo that have stepped on mines. Even elephants have stepped on mines. And some animals, they survive and some don't. And then for families, losing an animal can mean losing their only source of food or income. And usually there's no markets nearby. And so one explosion from a mine can destroy an entire family's survival. So demining, it's already happening, and it's happening with or without international support from people. And the communities, they just really can't wait for anyone to come and help them. So people are taking this on themselves, and they're clearing paths to these farms to these water sources, to these medical clinics, and to their schools and churches just out of necessity. And the work's happening, like I've already described, in active conflict zones where all the formal humanitarian access that they need is being blocked. And the choice really for them is not safety versus danger. It's danger now versus danger later. And so these local teams are using improvised tools and a lot of hard-earned experience that they've accumulated over decades and decades of fighting this war. And the M14 landmines that I've already mentioned, they're low metal. They're making detection super difficult. And most of the time, they're not using a detector because they don't have detectors. And people are taking enormous personal risk to try and clear these mines for their families and for their townships. So when the Burma army comes near, people just automatically assume that there's a mine that's being laid. If they have nowhere else to go, they will go back and they will try to clear the mines themselves so they can go back home. And it's usually one or two people in a village that will take on this role. And sometimes they're former soldiers and they might use a stick to scrape the ground or a knife to probe for mines. And if they find one, they will try and remove it themselves. And if no one in the village can do that, they will call somebody from one of the resistance groups. So somebody with experience will come and they'll clear it in the same way I've already described, without any formal demining program, without any funding for a demining team, and almost everything is done by local teams. And then they do this because they really have no choice. If they don't clear the land, then they can't go home, they can't farm, they can't rebuild.
So, I mean, it's a rock and a hard place situation, really, except the consequences are quite literally fatal in this instance. So I definitely feel for the people in that case. And this is where we start getting into the process of actually removing these mines. This is tricky. So you yourself, you say, you know, you're EOD, you're trained to, you know, deal with explosives, whether it's mines, whether it's UXO, whether it's IEDs, what have you. But I would presume that there are very few people now that we can discuss a little bit more about Free Burma Rangers and the work that you guys have been doing. How many other people are there working on this project who have any sort of formal training in explosive ordnance disposal?
Yeah, well, just a little bit more on the need for the organized demining and into that question. Most of the international demining models, they are assuming like a post-conflict like stability so that there's not an active conflict going on. And so for Burma, it's obviously an active conflict. So we have a shifting front line. We have constant displacement with IDPs. And at FBR, we have just decided that the clearance can't wait for any kind of peace agreement. And peace may never come. We don't know. We hope and pray for it, but we don't know when that will come. And then all the international funding and policy is lagging behind the reality of the situation on the ground. So, yeah, we're working with local groups to develop practical and field-driven solutions alongside the people that have invited us to help them. So we're trying to adapt agricultural machinery like flails to clear land, and we're trying to use AI-assisted detection to identify landmines or mine-like objects using just a simple drone. And then the goal for us is not high-tech for its own sake, but it's reducing risk and saving time and lives. You asked how many people are involved in this. Right now, I am and trying to lead the effort to establish a formalized program. And we have a few others at FBR that are helping. But most of the work right now, we are working alongside our partners within Burma. And we are trying to partner with them and really let them lead and tell us how we can be of most service to them. And we want this to be something sustainable and scalable and repeatable across all of Burma.
I mean, absolutely. And you mentioned this before, and I think that's a critical sort of perspective to understand what it is exactly that you're doing, that this is not so much Free Burma Rangers going into Burma, looking around and saying, oh, wow, there are a lot of landmines. Let's start a demining program. you're taking pre-existing demining operations such as they are, and you're trying to upskill and upscale. And I think that's a really vital point here. I want to understand the progression here. As you say, this is the longest civil conflict in history. And although you're saying that the landmine problem that we're dealing with today is not a relic of the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, but is rather predominantly landmines that have come post-2021 coup, landmines have been widely deployed for decades and decades and decades in Myanmar. And so a lot of groups, a lot of organizations have dealt with them for decades. They know how to deal with them. They already have demining activities. But I want to kind of get a conceptualization of this, because I assume that there is no dedicated demining organization that is purely internal, that is purely Myanmar, and that tries to cover as much of the country as possible. I would imagine that it's organically developed groups of people who are willing enough to take the risk and to get their hands on whatever training they can and learn from the people who came before and are just trying to do demining as best as they can within a sort of local area. But that's just my imagination. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about how have the people naturally been responding to the mine problem? How have they been going about attempting to manage demining? Have they managed to get their hands on any proper demining equipment? Have they managed before Free Burma Rangers to get access to proper demining training? What can you tell us about the state of demining?
Yeah. So some resistance groups, they've already started small efforts, but they're stretched thin and they're very under-resourced. So what's needed, in my opinion, and in FBR's opinion, is a two-part approach. The first is a professional full-time demining team that's connected to local forces like the KNDF or the IEC, and their job would be to clear mines and support communities. And second would be community-level demining training so that villagers can identify, they can mark, and in some cases also clear mines safely. So there are not enough experts there for them to wait on for help. And so the need is immediate for that. So local teams, they understand the terrain, the patterns of movement, and all the social dynamics. They know where people actually walk, where they farm, and where they gather. And they also, most importantly, they stay when any international group leaves. It's their home. And so that supporting them, we believe, is practical and also just very, very ethical. And so the last time we were in Karini, we had gone in there with a metal detector, and we had gone in there just to do a relief mission to support people at the front line and in different areas. And a group had heard that myself and another EOD tech were with the group. So they approached us and they asked if we would go with them to a minefield and help them. And that's what we did. And so that's what kind of started this relationship recently, where they have now invited us and asked us to partner with them to develop a demining solution alongside them. So they, you know, I'm in frequent contact with people with this group, and they have made it very clear like what their needs are, and they've already kind of ran me through what they're already trying to do. So it's communities in Karen State, in Karini, and then other nearby conflict areas. They've requested this clearance assistance, and it really it's just so they can return to their homes and to their farmland. That's their request. So we are trying to work with them to establish a pilot community-based clearance capability using their own personnel, trying to provide and work alongside them to give them professional training. It'd be a mixture of manual and mechanical tools. And like I said, the end state would be just safe access that allows families to return and hopefully also sets the foundation for creating an explosive hazard mitigation center. And that's the part that we really hope will just bring in more attention, more resources to the area. And these groups, they've already started to do some of the work, some of the hard work. They've actually already categorized some of the area into zones. So like red zones and yellow zones and green zones. Red zone being the Burma army had control of the area. They set up outposts and they were dug in. So they know those areas are highly contaminated. And then a green zone, like the least contaminated, maybe there is an airstrike. So there might be some UXO there, but there was no ground troops. And then like a yellow zone in between, maybe there was like a battle, but they didn't like dig into the area. So they didn't have as much time to set up booby traps and that sort of thing. So they already have some of these areas mapped. So they're trying their best, but they've identified what their gaps are. So major gaps include lack of detectors, lack of PPE, no mechanical equipment, no fuel, no money for fuel, no reliable repair capacity. There's just massive setbacks for them to do anything that's long lasting. So, our teams, we want to train, help train these people that are willing to go into their townships to demine. We want to train them trying to follow IMAS aligned standards as much as possible when it's feasible. And we want these teams to use the tools that we can provide for them, but also the mechanical systems that they can use to operate safely in their farmland and road environments that they're going to start to clear. And we want to reopen routes and reopen village approaches and farmlands to allow families to return. And like I said, build this foundation for a explosive hazard mitigation center.
And I think this is one of the most critical and inspirational parts of this. Yeah, I recently interviewed someone who's working on the refugee camps, the Karen refugee camps, Karen and Kareni, I should say, refugee camps in Thailand. And the comment was that those camps are run by a governance system that is democratically accountable, that is staffed by actual members of those communities, people who live in those camps, and the work that those governance groups do in order to do the research, get on boots on the ground, do a needs assessment, do a risk assessment, just deliver information to international organizations to lift that burden from them is of incalculable value, both financially and in terms of time, when missions are time critical. And again, what you're talking about resonates with me for that same reason, because it's you going in and saying, look, the community already knows where the mines are likely to be. They already know where they need to be able to go, what areas need to be cleared. As you say, they stay when international groups leave. So there is long-term support. And the amount of work and effort and time that they've already put in, even if they're not trained to the highest level, the identification work is, I would imagine, an incredibly slow and time-consuming process. If you're an outside organization who's not familiar with the land and the terrain and the history of the conflict over the previous weeks and months, as I would assume that the work that they're doing would be saving you full days, if not weeks, of research and boots on the ground time that can now be spent on actual critical demining operations. So it seems that this is going to be significantly more successful and more sustainable. And what I want to ask is whether you know of any other cases like this. Is there any other part of the world, is there any other conflict region where demining or approaches to these sort of vestiges of conflict, whether it's mines, whether it's UXO, whether it's what have you, are being led by the communities with international organizations merely in supporting roles? Or is it generally going to be the case that international groups want to be the ones who go in, they use only their own people, they do all of their own assessments, and they follow their own procedures, and they're not really allowing the local communities to take the lead on needs assessment, to take the lead on mapping, or take the lead on the direction that the operations are going to be conducted?
Yeah, so there definitely are examples of other community-based demining efforts around the world. I think that the unique thing about Burma is that we're trying to do this in an active conflict area. So in Ukraine, there have been some teams that have done something like it, but Burma is very unique. It's a closed country, getting anything into the country to work towards this demining effort is very challenging, very difficult. So there's a lot of differences. So I think it's hard to really compare anything to what's going on in Burma right now. A lot of the other ones that you'll see with community-based mining, a lot of them are just education. I don't mean to say just, but they're just because of the just restrictions and the safety that goes into it. They focus mainly on education and providing ID capabilities, stuff like that. But taking it, you know, further to actually like training people to go and remove the mines, that's one area that's very unique for what we're trying to do, but also do that in a conflict zone. So we can glean some information from how other people have done this, but this is pretty unique, I would say, from what I've read about and people I've spoken to.
Absolutely. And we're definitely going to be looking at the results that you're seeing so far and what you're anticipating. But I want to get a scope from the education perspective, because, you know, as you say, it's not just education. Education is a pretty critical element of this. The obvious question that arises, though, is, I mean, you're Navy trained EOD. I would assume, or at least I would hope, that your EOD training was quite extensive, and would have taken place over the course of weeks, probably months, and a lot of hands-on experience with I imagine in the US you'd have a lot of expensive shiny gadgets that allow you to get hands-on experience in a way that is realistic but is also completely safe. So you have the benefit of that. Now I know that earlier you noted that you were trained in pretty much everything. It's not just landmines, but it, you know, it's unexploded ordnance, it's biological weapons, it's chemical weapons, it's radiological weapons, it's what have you. And a lot of that information is not relevant to the Burmese context. We just need to get people to be able to deal with landmines. And from what you're saying, it sounds like predominantly it's the M14 landmine and maybe a few other types. But the question is still there. How much time does it take to bring a farmer, someone who's never had military experience, someone who's never worked with explosives before, to be able to enter an area where there might be landmines and be able to safely search for mines, to be able to reliably identify landmines, to be able to systematically flag those and communicate that to other teams, and potentially even at the highest level, how long does it take to train a person to be able to go in and dispose of a landmine safely?
Yeah, there's the time that I had in the Navy was very privileged in the sense that I had almost 2 years of training that went into preparing me. The scope of the explosive threats in Burma, a lot different. And we've already been teaching some of these skills to Rangers in Burma. And we've been teaching basic mine clearance using knives and sticks and basic tools and basic safeties and also ordnance identification. That's already being done. So we've been doing that, and that happens over the course of that portion right there happens over the course of a few weeks. So we want to take that further, and we want to now just add on top of that for our community-based demining model, how to flag things, how to try to map things, and how to use tools that we previously didn't or weren't able to bring to people, like how to use these tools. We want to teach them how to use the flail detectors. That's something that we are trying to build support for, to teach them how to use metal detectors properly, and good metal detectors, because you can get cheap ones that aren't intended for mines, which out of necessity and just because of resource restriction, they were using some of these like hobbyist detectors. So we're getting detectors now that are made for landmine use, for humanitarian landmine use. So in a to train people how to do identification, how to do basic mine probing, and how to use mapping, using technology to help map areas, using drones, like I already mentioned. This is something that can be done relatively quickly. Are they going to be experts? Are they going to be the same qualification or the same level of an IMAS EOD or humanitarian mine action D minor? Like, no. But are they going to be in a situation where they're a lot safer for something that they're going to do anyways, regardless if we give them this training or not? Like, absolutely. And so I think what we're seeing is just people are going into these areas and doing this work regardless. So we want to do our best to work with them, knowing that we do have some experience, like, for sure, that we want to try to work alongside them with to develop this program. And we know they're going to be better off going through this program and this training, and far more equipped as well. So, and then we do think then our hope is to try to give more specific training to certain people on the ground, where when they do experience more higher threat scenarios, like the booby traps, like we're seeing in some of the homes, or some of the landmines are booby trapped, when they're seeing stuff like that, or IEDs, which again, we're also seeing those, that there are people that have, again, a basic understanding of how some of these things function. And so again, they're already going after these things anyways, and they're trying to clear them without any training. So we want to go and provide some type of training for them using our knowledge and help them out as much as possible. And we're really just doing our best to listen to what their needs are and what they're asking for, and to work alongside them as safely as we can. We understand what the IMAS standards are, and we want to try and follow those when it makes sense, when it's feasible. But most importantly, we just really care about people in Burma, and we want to try and help them make their land safe and free again so they can return home. So this situation looks, it's complex, and it requires a lot of creative thinking and adaptability. And it's kind of new territory for how some of this stuff is going to be done. And so we're also just understanding that as we move forward, we might have to make some changes, and we might have to adapt things. So we're trying to be responsible, and we're also just trying to make sure that we're putting the community that we're working with first in all these things and what they're asking for.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's a statement that you hear quite a bit, that a thing doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be better than what we currently have. And I know this is very early days, and you wouldn't have any data because, you know, this hasn't been going on long enough for there to be any appreciable feedback. But I am curious, what would you anticipate the difference to be? And do you have a scope for fatalities currently? Because I would imagine if you've got a group of people going in who don't have particular training, who don't have the best tools, that demining would be a very high fatality job. Is there a sort of a figure that we can look at that would indicate the level of success, like the number of mines a person is able to dispose of, or life expectancy within this sort of job? And if it is quantifiable, what sort of improvement would you expect as a result of the training that you and Free Burma Rangers are offering?
Yeah. I don't know if we have direct numbers or not on how we could show the impact from this program that we're trying to establish or not. That would be valuable, and that would be helpful. And we do believe, though, that it by equipping people, for example, with there's blast proof boots that are made to withstand the impact of a anti-personnel mine, and a protective set of trousers that you wear on your legs when you're walking through a minefield that would protect you from the blast from an anti-personnel mine. Basic PPE to protect your face, to protect your arms, those sorts of things going into these minefields are going to already provide just immediate protection and help mitigate a lot of the injuries that we're seeing. Most of the time it's like from your knee down, sometimes you're growing. So we want to provide adequate PPE. So we do believe that it's certainly going to reduce injury and fatality as well. And then even basics like necessities like fuel. The machine that they were using was a track hoe that was for farm use, but they figured out how to use this to dig up areas of their land to blow up some of these mines. And this, the one that we actually saw, was a village member's personal track hoe that he used for his business. But he had volunteered this track hoe for this group to use to clear these mines. And then somebody else in another part of the area needed this track hoe to go dig ditches for bunkers. And so they had to remove this track hoe that was being volunteered by one individual from this minefield and send it to another area. And so we want to provide them fuel, but we want to provide them the heavy machine equipment so that they have a permanent machine that they can use for demining that's not going to get pulled from anywhere else, and nobody has to volunteer, but that we're going to teach them how to operate and use effectively. And then with the PPE that I already mentioned, with the metal detectors that we are going to test in the field to make sure that they work on the M14 mine before we train them on them. All the other excavation equipment, our pinpoint detectors that we're trying to supply, the marking materials, the drone technology, you know, these are all the things that we're hoping will save lives.
And I understand you're also building a flail of the scale and the size and the type that that we would have seen back in World War II, or well, not quite that large, but still a very large rotating drone with a whole bunch of chains attached. Can you tell us a little bit about that particular tool? Because I think for a lot of people, that's just something that we've seen stock footage of from World War II era sort of demining operations. But it is something that people don't realize is actually a very useful piece of equipment.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an exciting that's an exciting piece of equipment. And really, just talking to a friend of mine who just so happened to know how to build these types of heavy machines, I told him what the problem was. The problem was that we want something to take into these fields to help blow the mines up and clear the topsoil from an area, so that then we can send manual clearance deminers through afterwards. And talking to some of the manufacturers that make some of this equipment, some of those machines cost $400,000 plus. And these are very advanced machines that are, you know, drone operated and very, very safe, very large, and, you know, made in countries far, far away. And that only includes just the cost of the machine, not to mention the shipping and the maintenance and everything else. So just completely out of our budget. But it was great to see, you know, how other people do this that have the privilege to purchase a machine like that. So I talked to him about it, and he felt like that was something he could do. So we met with another partner, and we're building a flail from the ground up, starting with the chassis to putting the tractor tread on there, the diesel motor, the hydraulic system, and then the cab or protective, like a cab that we're going to then up arm, put with blast protective glass. And then we're going to try and get this into Burma. And we're going to train people how to operate this flail. It has a rotating bar across the front of it with chains that rotates at a very high speed. And he is essentially just removing the topsoil from an area enough so that an anti-personnel mine would explode. And then anything that's not exploded, it would try and kick up, and then we'd be able to hand remove it and disarm it. So that machine right there alone, and it's something that we could also maintain with minimal costs. It's something that we could just replace the chains when they wear out. We're not going to have to like call some other foreign country to send that one part that then puts the machine inoperable until that happens. We're going to also train people to repair it when it needs to be repaired, so that demining operations can continue. So if this goes well with this flail, the person who's helping us build it is prepared to build many more of them. So we're hoping that the cost of this thing is like $40,000 versus the $400,000 I mentioned. We're hoping we'll be able to reduce the cost of a flail or future flails and continue to improve it and be able to bring more of them into Burma, into all the other areas that are mined. So Yeah.
Hmm. I mean, it's incredible, but I mean, you are talking about this cost. I mean, you're saying like $400,000 for a professionally made flail third party. Some of the other equipment, I mean, you're talking about the PPE, those blast suits, I was looking them up. I mean, they're going for what, $30,000 US for a full set. Not that I envy anyone wearing that in the Burmese weather, but a lot of this stuff is phenomenally expensive. And of course, I imagine it's a very niche product. They don't produce a lot of it, and a lot of it would just be layers and layers and layers of Kevlar, which is already quite expensive. But are you looking to raise money to be able to purchase these from third parties, or are you more so looking for locally produced alternatives that are going to give you the same result at a fraction of the price?
Yeah. So we want to do, we don't care how we get it. We want to do everything we can to get them the equipment that they need. So we are doing that through talking to these third party distributors and people who are producing this stuff in other countries where it's already made for other conflict zones. I'm talking to two or three different companies right now trying to figure out how to get it. There's a lot of difficulty doing that. A lot of it trying to get it into Burma is just restrictive. So trying to figure out how to manage some of those details and get it there. It's just the difficulty, you know, in a country where humanitarian aid is hard to get into the country. So that's one of the restrictions right now, is just being able to even get it there. And then the cost, like you said, it is very expensive. And we are trying to think creatively on what we can do, trying to raise support clearly to do that. We always need to funding. We have very little of it. And demining is very expensive. It's not something you want to go cheap on either. You know, if I'm in that minefield, I want to have a reliable detector. I want to have the best boots possible that are going to protect my feet. And I want to have the best protective equipment for, you know, my face and all those things. You know, if it were you, you'd want the best as well in that minefield. So it's like we're trying to do it safely, and we're trying to get equipment that is IMAS approved. And a lot of these items that we're looking at, they actually do have that IMAS approval on them. So we want to try and follow that, because we understand that international organizations recognize that as the standard, and we want to try and follow that standard as much as we can. But again, similar to like the tactics on the ground, some of this PPE is just far out of our price range, and we can't afford it. So if we could develop this stuff locally, like, we would be all for that, and trying to do that in the right way that's safe. Again, we don't want to give them anything that I wouldn't wear. I don't want to give them any PPE that I wouldn't wear myself to walk into that minefield. So we're doing our best to try to figure out how to do this low cost, how to make it scalable, how to make it repeatable. And we want this to be long lasting. So it is going to require a lot of money. We don't have very much money at all. We're working with a super limited budget. And we're doing our best. And same thing with like asking, we ask a lot of companies like, hey, this is what we're attempting to do. Would you be willing to donate something to us for this project, to include the detectors, to include the PPE? You know, there's a lot of things that go into this with like government contracts and other things that increase the price of some of these items. And we're just not one of those players that we can afford those types of things. We have no government contracts or anything like that. A lot of it is just donation. It's all donation based, what people give out of the kindness of their heart towards this cause. So that's also why we appreciate this time on air to talk about this issue. It's not something that gets a ton of airtime, and most people don't really know what's happening. So very grateful for this time.
And I mean, we're very grateful for the work that you do. And I think this is a good opportunity to remind people that Free Burma Rangers have been operating in Myanmar for a very long time, and quite a reputable organization. If you are looking for a place to put your money where you know it's going to go towards saving lives and improving the quality of life, then we would strongly encourage you to look into donating as much as you're able to. This is a slight detraction, but I mean, how often do you get to talk to someone in EOD? When it comes to landmines, the Hollywood trope that if you step on a landmine but you don't step off the landmine, you have an infinite amount of time to be able to defuse the mine under your feet. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's movies. I think, isn't there a movie? I forget what it's called. I haven't seen it, but there's a movie where somebody does something like that. Yeah. I've never been in that situation, but in theory, if you step on it and you don't release your foot, you should have an unlimited amount of time. Definitely not something I've specifically trained to, but, yeah, I think most of the times that we see people step on these mines, it happens so quickly. You don't realize you've stepped on it until it's already gone off. But, and on that too, that like the way people are stepping on them in combat zones, we've been talking a lot about the steady state demining that we're trying to do, following an IMAS standard, the humanitarian demining. But there's also there are resistance groups that are clearing mines at the front line. And these guys, they're doing clearance while fighting. And the security conditions, they change week to week, sometimes day to day. The type of clearance that we're talking about now, we could be clearing in an area and then an airstrike comes in, heavy artillery comes in. It could be troop movement of the Burma army that could come to an area. So there's drones and, you know, everything else in the air. So it's still high risk anywhere you go, to include the areas that we're trying to do this steady state clearance in these villages. But there are people that are trying to demine at the front line, and they can't pause. They can't wait, you know, again, for peace to come. They just go. So these guys are demining in an active conflict zone, and it's just brutal. So people are under fire from mortars, from drones, from jets, heavy artillery, like while they're clearing these mines. In Papun, they had a team that was clearing a path at night. They were crawling forward just meter by meter, probing on the ground with their knives. And each night they advanced just a little bit, and then they pulled back before daylight. And then on the day of the assault, sometimes they'll use like a Bangalore torpedo or a PVC charge to clear the final stretch. But otherwise they'll just rush through the area that they had partially cleared. It's so dangerous. Like, especially these guys at the front, they have really no certainty, about anything that they're doing, at the front, because it's so rapidly, evolving. So it's just that demining is, and landmine clearance and explosive hazard mitigation is extremely dangerous anywhere you go. But these guys at the front, it's just particularly brutal. So dangerous.
I mean, as you say, they partially clear the area and then they'll rush through it. And this brings us to an important question. In mine clearing, can we ever reach a point where you can confidently say that an area has been completely demined, that an area is completely safe to enter, whether it's under the conditions you're seeing in Burma, whether it's under ideal conditions? Is that ever achievable, or are you always going to have to put that asterisk there and say, well, we've cleared any mines that we were able to identify and we're able to detect, but there's always going to be the risk that there are lingering mines that down the line, some years down the line, someone's going to activate?
Yeah, there's always going to be a risk. We can do our best, and you know, you can claim a percentage of confidence that an area is cleared and safe. And clearly you want that number to be as high as possible, but ultimately there is no guarantee. You know, there's places all over the world that there's still UXO and mines and stuff that are lingering. There is no 100% confidence in that.
I mean, it's a horrifying thing now. And this, again, I'm wondering, bringing on your expertise, whether you can speak to this. It is my understanding, and I may be wrong, that there are currently mines being used, I believe, by the resistance in Burma, which are battery operated. And the idea is that they will sit in the ground or wherever you place them. Someone steps on them. There's an electrical circuit that completes and it causes the mine to detonate. But the batteries are batteries and they degrade over time, so that statistically speaking, you would say after a certain number of years, those mines would be deactivated by default. Is there any truth to that assertion?
Yeah, I think that that there are some of these, I would call them homemade explosives that we have seen with batteries. And some of those batteries for some of these models that I've seen, they are required for the mine to function or for the explosive to function. But I think that for anyone to think that because a battery were to expire, that somehow it doesn't pose a threat any longer, that's just not true. Like there's still an explosive in the ground, and it's still a danger. It's still a risk. So I think that a lot of the attempts to try and make landmines more safe, where they have like a timer on them, there's still going to be a threat involved in it. So we've seen all sorts of things. We've seen things made out of bamboo, out of PVC pipe. We've seen modified pieces of like scooters and pieces of motors that have been used for blast fragmentation. We've seen all sorts of really creative things that people are making. There's bomb makers that are trying to make these things as difficult as possible, and they're actually like targeting people going into these minefields now. So that even if you do go put like these M14s, there's some of them that have booby traps on the bottoms of them. So when you pull that mine out of the ground, if you're trained to do so, you then have something beneath it that will clack off and set off another explosive somewhere else. So there's all sorts of creative ways that people are now understanding how clearance operations are starting to happen. And then they're trying to target the EOD techs as well, or the deminers. So,
yeah. I mean, that's particularly insidious. I know we've seen examples in history where you had explosive devices designed with two charges, a primary and a secondary charge, and the concept being that the primary charge would attract medical personnel or rescue personnel, and you'd estimate the amount of time it would take someone to get there, and then the secondary charge would go off and you know, was designed to kill those more humanitarian oriented personnel. And I just do think that's a particularly insidious strategy to try to employ. But as we already discussed today, the military is actively and deliberately targeting civilians, including children, with landmines. So it's not exactly shocking revelation at this point. Unfortunate. So what this comes down to is that coming back to building the community capacity. I mean, we've spoken about the training that you're delivering. We've spoken about the tools that you're trying to develop or that you're trying to source, and all of these things. Again, numbers are a good thing. Do you have any scope of across the country? Because it's something like 2/3 of the country is contaminated with landmines. So across Myanmar, we are talking about in the tens of millions of people who are directly or indirectly affected by the threat of landmines. Is there any estimate that you might have for the number of people across the country who are engaged in this type of community mine clearing? And because your team, I assume, is very limited in size and scope, what percentage of the communities who are engaged in this activity do you think you can feasibly get to and train and help to equip?
Yeah. So I can only speak to the area that we're right now trying to work with specifically. And that's a very small team, less than 10 people within this region of Burma. But we have had people from other, you know, FBR operates all over the country. We've had people from other regions that have asked for this type of support. So there's clearly a desire for it. A lot of it is just largely budget and then establishing a program that we can scale to reach more people. We don't really know of many other NGOs. We don't know of any other NGOs that are doing what we're attempting to do here. But as far as like the local based demining stuff, I think every region has some people that are locally trained to go and take care of these mines. They've been doing this for decades and decades and decades. So I don't have a number though that I can give you on how many there are.
Fair. I mean, that's fair. And is there any other community need here? Like obviously equipment and training. That's granted. But is there anything else beyond that these communities need in order to be able to develop these projects? Is there a degree of not just developing that community, but establishing relationships between different community demining groups so that they can cross-train and so they can collaborate? Is there any other element that you're able to provide to these groups?
Yeah, so we want to try to give them as much as possible. So I think I mentioned earlier that we want to develop an explosive hazard mitigation center. So I think it's important to note that we don't want to just establish a mine action center, which has been done in many parts around the world, which is helpful to take care of just landmines. But the problem is much larger than just landmines in Burma. Like I've already mentioned, there's booby traps, there's IEDs. We've even had threats of, or not threats, but reports of chemical weapon attacks. The problem is pervasive, and it's a lot bigger than just landmines. So we want to develop a explosive hazard mitigation center, which would then bring hopefully international recognition of the issue, that we'd be able to serve as a center for training and for research and for mapping. And we want to attract and bring in more people to FBR and to Burma to help with this, to help with training, to help with expanding this program. And then I think something that we're trying to really do beyond that is bring in recognized training. It's one thing for us to go and provide our own experience and training program, which we're going to do our best at, and we're going to work within the restrictions and just the environment in Burma. But we want to try and hopefully attract people like they've done in Ukraine, where there's like a humanitarian mine action training program that they, I think, I don't know where it is in Ukraine, but somewhere in Ukraine, there's organizations that have started these training programs there because of the need for that. We want to bring that to Burma, like come to Burma and come and train people there, and train people on all of these humanitarian mine action skill sets that are then going to be recognized, you know, and hopefully then it's recognized by the rest of the world for the conflict that we get to see every single day and how serious it is. So yeah, if we could bring in people to come and train people in Burma, because they can't go to these other countries. We've thought about that. They can't go to Ukraine. They can't go to, I think it's in Denmark is where the other program is, and there's some in the United States. They can't go to these places. They don't have passports. They don't have freedom of movement. They're trapped in their own country in the middle of this war. So it's a very, very difficult, tough situation. So unless you're willing to go into Burma, like some of us are, to provide some of this training, nobody's able to get in to help them. So, you know, if there are people that are willing to try and work with us, where we can try and get them in, I think that would be an area where we could help them more. Getting some of that recognized training in the country. And in the event that we were to find somebody that had a passport that was able to leave the country to go and receive some of this IMAS level training in other places, like that would be a wonderful thing as well, to have that supported, because we really want them to be empowered. We want them to have the expertise and the training that's long lasting, where they can train their own people and have this experience to continue building this program with us. So yeah, we would just seek more partnership with other people that want to come and help us, but also that would be creative in trying to figure out how to work within these restrictions, where humanitarian assistance is just very difficult to get into the country.
Absolutely. And I mean, it comes back to that question of the difference between a demining operation post-conflict, when you have time and you have space and you can bring people and equipment into the country relatively safely, versus the situation that you're faced with, which is demining in an active war zone, where a territory that you demine today could be recaptured by the military and remined tomorrow. the really, really unpleasant situation to be in. And I genuinely feel for you, and I'm truly inspired by the work of your team and yourself and everyone in the country who's frankly, average people who've put their hands up and said, you know what, I'm willing to handle explosive with my bare hands for the benefit of my community. It's an incredibly brave and admirable thing to do. I think it kind of takes a very special mentality, though.
Yeah, I think I'll just put it out right now too. We're going to put this on our website soon. We're actually going to put a posting up for a volunteer. We're looking for more volunteers to come and help with this effort. We're looking for somebody that is EOD qualified from the military or that has their HMA training, EOD level 3 training on the civilian side to come and help here. It's not a very attractive offer according to a lot of people. We can't pay. So you have to do it for free and you have to be willing to go into Burma and you have to be able to really live and work in the same conditions that the people in Burma are living and working in. So we're looking for more people to come and join us that are willing to, if they have that skill set that they want to use to help people in Burma that are desperately in need, go to our website and you'll see pretty soon a job posting there to come and be a volunteer to work alongside us. So it does require, I think, a certain type of person to come and do this. And you look at the people that are on the ground doing this, it's remarkable. It's incredible the hope that they have for their country and their resilience. Seeing people that have lost just so many family members, that have lost their limbs, that just continue. Like one of the things that we see mostly is when people lose a limb, is they're just sad and depressed and upset that they can't go back to the front line. And a lot of times if they, it's very expensive and difficult for a lot of them to get prosthetics, but if they get one, they want to go right back to the front. So it's remarkable to see the determination of the people in Burma and how determined they are to not surrender, to keep going. Even with the desperation of the situation, it's just created a lot of ingenuity and their hearts are so for this. So I consider it a great honor to work alongside them. It's a privilege to be invited to work alongside people that care so deeply about their communities and that are willing to do anything to figure this out. And I can't imagine being somebody who grew up in a country like Burma and just seeing generations on generations of families that have had to fight, that didn't want to, but they had to become soldiers. And then really to feel ignored. So many of them report that they just feel like they're invisible, like the world doesn't care about them. It's very sad. And it's like, when I see that, like, I just feel like my heart is with them and we want to do anything possible, to stand with them. So it's pretty remarkable every time, being around people, that are working in this space in Burma, just at all, but especially for, the explosive situation is pretty remarkable. So, yeah.
I absolutely agree. And I think that's one of the most depressing but most recurring themes in doing this work and talking to so many experts and so many people both within the country and without is that fundamentally the international community doesn't care. Burmese lives don't matter to the same extent that lives elsewhere matter. I mean, we obviously fully support the defense of Ukraine against Russian aggression. They are committing war crimes against the Ukrainian people. They are committing crimes against humanity in Ukraine. And it is good and just for us to oppose that. But it's a little bit salt in the wound to have to be confronted with the fact that when the same types of crimes and offenses are being committed in Southeast Asia, the international community is not quite so eager to step up and offer assistance. So it's genuinely, I sympathize with you and with the difficulty of the task ahead of you. And I think, yeah, the offer is probably not particularly tantalizing, but it would be an honor and a distinction to work with people who just do not lie down, who just keep getting up and keep moving forward and keep doing it and just have a tenacity and an ingenuity and a complete wholehearted dedication to a goal, a righteous goal at that. it genuinely would be a privilege. And I do hope that there are other like-minded people. I know I've had the privilege of speaking to people, whether they are combatants, whether they are journalists, whether they are experts, whether they're humanitarians who have gone to Burma and have worked without compensation for the greater good and for the cause and for the benefit of the people who cannot defend themselves. And I do hope that you get some of the support that you need and that your teams need and that ultimately that Burma needs.
Thank you. Yeah, I think I'd like to just say, for me and my family, we really feel called to do this because we love the people in Burma and we really want to share God's love with them. And we understand the risk and we pray about everything that we do. And, my wife and I, we have our son with us as well. He's 15 months old. We really feel that God has given us gifts and we want to serve others and use what God's given us to try and love other people. But I would just ask and invite anyone listening to please to pay attention to Burma beyond headlines. I think sometimes when I look at things on the internet, it's easy to look at really depressing statistics and reports. But there are stories out there of just incredible tenacity and bravery and resilience. It is just remarkable. There is a lot of hope, and you can feel that hope when you're with these people. There's darkness, and they recognize the darkness, but there's light there too, and you can see that light and you can feel that light with the people that we're with. So, I would just ask that we, if there's anyone that's listening that wants to support locally led clearance and survivor care, please, we need it. And I would just also ask anyone listening, this could be, if you're with one of these larger demining organizations or you're with a defense tech company, or you can provide PPE or metal detectors, some of the things that we've talked about here, just, we'd like to advocate for just flexible funding, that works in active conflict zones. I know that there's typically a lot of restrictions with donor money, who they want to give to and for what reasons. And the conflict in Burma can scare a lot of people away from it because of things they see involvement with war and stuff like that, which we understand. We all hate this war and we want to see it end. But I would just invite people to have an open heart and to try and be flexible with funding for this conflict in Burma. And just also just really remember that every path that we clear, every township that we clear, it's helping to restore not just land, but also dignity and life for people that are desperately, desperately doing everything they can to try and restore that. And yeah, as a reminder, it's the longest running civil war in the world. And the people of Burma, they want freedom. They are our friends and they need help. Burma is one of the most heavily mined countries on earth. The military is laying thousands of mines at a time around camps and villages and homes and farmland and trade routes. They're not just targeting soldiers, as we've talked about. And yeah, what's needed, full-time, well-equipped demining teams and community-level teams. And we also just want to say thank you to everyone who has supported this work and helped fund our demining efforts. Everyone who's given to support this cause, like you have helped save lives, you've helped restore land, and you're giving hope to people in Burma, but you're giving hope to myself and all the other people that are working to try to figure out how to make this work. So that's very important. Like for us to even begin this work, we've received some recognition and some help. So just thank you, people early on that have just heard about what we're trying to do and have wanted to support. Like, thank you. And we just hope and pray that is just the beginning of a larger effort and expansion of trying to clear Burma of landmines and booby traps and IEDs and all the other explosive threats. So last thing would just be that, yeah, people are not waiting for peace to live. They're not waiting for someone to come save them. They're risking their lives to survive. And we're just pleading with anyone listening for the world to just meet them where they are. It's a very difficult situation. There's so many reasons why it would make sense for somebody not to decide to help, but we're just pleading with the world, meet the people of Burma where they are in this effort. And thank you.
Thank you for being a part of this conversation and standing in solidarity with the people and the stories shared here. At Insight Myanmar Podcast, solidarity is not just a word. It's the foundation of everything we do. Each voice we amplify and every story we share represents a call to stand together with those in Myanmar. And so it is through the act of listening, reflecting, and engaging that you become part of this collective effort to uphold dignity, amplify truth, and stand firm for what matters. And I should also add that all of this work is only made possible because of listeners like you who have chosen to offer a contribution. Every donation is an act of standing together, of refusing to turn away, and of reinforcing the bonds that connect us across borders and experiences. If you believe in the power of solidarity and the importance of sharing these stories, we invite you to join us by making a donation. Your support helps us to keep this platform alive and ensure that those voices continue to be heard. Visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to join us in standing with Myanmar.
Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,